נגילה הווה, נגילה הווה, נגילה ונשמחה. הווה, נגילה הווה, נגילה הווה, נגילה ונשמחה. הווה נרננה, הווה נרננה, הווה נרננה ונשמחה. הווה נרננה, הווה נרננה, הווה נרננה ונשמחה. אורו, אורו אחים, אורו אחים בלב שמח, אורו אחים בלב שמח, אורו אחים בלב שמח, אורו אחים בלב שמח, אורו אחים, אורו אחים בלב שמח. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Judge Eve Show, and I hope you enjoyed the music, which is Israeli, and it says, let's be happy. And I'm so blessed today to have Peter Kling on. He's a scientist, a Bible scholar. In fact, he's known as the Einstein of biblical prophecy. He's written the book Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon, which can be obtained on his website, www.peterkling.com, also Amazon and Barnes & Noble. He's been studying the Bible ever since he was 5 years old. He became a scientist, and I'm going to have him tell us about that, and found many answers to his biblical questions. And I didn't know it, Peter, but you were in Who's Who, both educative and professional life. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you very much, Eve. I love the introduction. Great.
Oh, thank you. Tell me, what were you on in Who's Who for professional life? First, tell us maybe what kind of a scientist you are. I know a good one, but what kind?
Well, I studied chemistry. I actually started studying chemistry at the age of 10. I was one of those little geeky kids that always needed to know answers to things. And
really?
I had my own chemistry set at 10 years old, and it just kept on going from there. I actually worked for one of the larger companies in the world as a research and development chemist. So,
you're kidding. Wow.
And that's really where I started my investigation of the Bible. I kind of grew up in a paradox world where I was being taught Bible prophecy and history, not from a religious viewpoint per se, but from a historic viewpoint and from a prophetic viewpoint of things to come.
Why was it that way? Was it in church or in school, or how were you taught that way?
Well, and by some very interesting people. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Yes.
But it was something that I grew up with, and not really from a religious standpoint, as people would think of religion today. Very little dogma. As a matter of fact, no dogma whatsoever. Mm. It was just pure Bible knowledge and study, both from a historic standpoint and from the prophetic standpoint.
What got you interested in it, though, Peter? Being a chemist and a scientist, why were you also interested in what appears to be a spiritual subject matter?
Well, I really had little choice about the biblical end of it because my parents saw to it for some interesting reason that I needed to know this.
Good.
And, you know, that's where it started first, was really I understood the biblical prophecies, not all of them, but most of them, by the time I was 7 or 8 years old. I understood the theme of the Bible.
Really? You see, you were meant to do all of this. My goodness. Yeah, go ahead. Are you an extraterrestrial?
I've wondered sometimes.
Yes. Go ahead, Peter. Forgive me for interruption.
Not a problem, but actually, when I look back at my life, here I am, 56 years old. There's been so many odd events. I've often said I wouldn't wish my life on anyone.
Really?
But there are so many strange events that it's made me question the purpose of my birth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's no way for me to actually go back far enough, I guess, unless I went through progressive hypnosis or regressive hypnosis. To really understand if there was a pre-life situation there. But I look at all of these things that have happened, and it makes me wonder.
What caused you to write the book, Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon? And you say you have another book coming on, too.
An interesting set of events which led me to Ukraine.
Really?
Yeah, I went through a kind of a difficult time in my life, and I wound up deciding, well, I've always wanted to go to Ukraine. I'm going. And I decided this in 10 days. As a matter of fact, before I left, about a half an hour before I had to go for the airport, my passport and visa finally showed up. So
no kidding.
Was interesting.
How long ago was that, Peter?
This was about 7 years ago.
Yeah, go ahead. And interesting, you should want to go to the Ukraine of all places, right?
Yeah, well, I always had an interest in Russia seemed to be too big. I always wanted to go to a previous, one of the socialistic countries of the USSR. And Russia just seemed to be too big. And I thought, you know what?
Yeah.
I want to go to Ukraine. So, and that's what I did. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite city, my only favorite city in the world, is Kiev. I love Kiev.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Great place.
Yeah.
But while I was in Ukraine, I had a young woman as my translator. I didn't realize actually how young she was. She was only 18, so kind of out of the mouths of babes. And and after about 2 or 3 weeks of her translating for me, I decided, well, why don't we have lunch together sometime? And so we did. We sat down and we were eating lunch. And, she had been listening to what I had been talking about for the past few weeks. And she said, you know, with everything that you know, you need to write a book.
Wow.
And I said, I wouldn't even know where to start to write a book. I'm not a writer.
Yeah.
And she said, well, just say it like you talk about it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I could do that. And so I kind of started, when I got back to the United States, I started on the book, and every time I would get in past chapter one, something would happen, and I wind up losing it. So I set it off to the side for a while and picked up business. I actually started doing business in Ukraine. And just when I was ready to become what I would consider successful, I got ill. And this was in 2008, between the fall of the collapse of the economy and the collapse of my own health, wound up losing everything.
Oh, Peter. God, the master setup, right? He allows us to go through things which we don't understand at the time, and later we see why they were allowed. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I consider that my Jonah years, because I was truly in the belly of the fish. No one had really expected me to survive this, and it was pretty dismal. I had my relatives coming and visiting me basically for what was going to seem to be like the last time. They were coming from all over the country.
Oh, my goodness.
But the doctors figured it out, and I needed to have some surgery done, and I was back on the road to health. But I had nothing left in my life except the words that were ringing in my ears from this young Ukrainian girl to write a book. And so I did.
You see what I mean about God? He'll do whatever it takes to get us to be on the purpose that he has set up us on this earth for, right?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I was told to do this, and I thought it was a good idea.
Yes.
But I didn't follow through. I went the business route, and I was having successes. Everything that I touched was kind of like turning to gold. It was all working out for the positive.
And got you off the track.
Yeah, it certainly did. And so I had to lose everything in order to get back on track, kind of like when they threw Jonah off the boat and the fish ate him and spit him back out and said, hey, you got a job to go do.
And he did it, didn't he? I know.
Yeah,
so, Peter, you know what? I would like to hear a little bit more. I know you believe in Jesus as I do, as our Savior. And what I'd like to hear is, why do you feel people need to read your book? Why do they need to know what you have to say?
It'll give them a different perspective on the Scriptures, because I don't look at the Scriptures from a religious viewpoint. I look at them from a scientific viewpoint.
Yes.
And that's been, this research started 35 years ago while I was working in a research and development lab. I was reading the book of Jonah. Sorry, the book of Job. And when I got to the 38th chapter, I believe it's around the 21st verse where it says, God is asking Job, have you seen my storehouses of ice and snow, which I have saved for the day of distress and war?
Wow.
And I'm thinking, what would What would Job know about storehouses of ice and snow? He lived in the Middle East.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I kind of played Google Earth in my mind, and I backed up and I started looking at, you know, first I looked through the eyes of Job. I mean, the eyes of Job. And all I could see is the snow on the mountaintops. And I thought, well, that's not really a storehouse. And so I started backing up, playing Google Earth. This is long before the internet. I started looking at the globe from space. And when I got back far enough in my mind, I could see, there they are at the poles. And then I thought, well, how do you use snow and ice?
Yeah.
Well, you can either make more of it or you can melt it. And I thought, well, what if the polar ice caps melted? How deep would the oceans get? Well, it took about 10 years to find that information because global and warming had not yet become a term.
Yes.
And so
you feel we are having global warming? Because I don't. I mean, to me, we're just going through another cycle.
We're going through Earth changes. There's no doubt about it that the Earth is not, the weather patterns are not the way they used to be. And the ice caps are melting. They're melting at an extreme rate now. The scientists the scientists said, well, you know, they're melting, but, you know, they're not melting that quickly. And I thought, yeah, this is going to be like throwing a snowball down a big hill, and it's only going to pick up speed and magnitude as it goes down the hill. And that's sure enough what they're finding, because now those ice caps are melting at an unprecedented rate. So we are in a time of distress. We say, well, how are we in this time of distress? Okay.
Yes.
Let's take Fiji.
Yes.
The people of Fiji have an open invitation by New Zealand that they can move there anytime they want.
Fiji, didn't they have the tsunami there a few years ago?
I don't think it actually hit Fiji. It was west of Fiji. But the average height of Fiji is only 7 feet above sea level.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, people have been saying, well, Venice is sinking. No, Venice isn't sinking. The ocean levels are rising.
No kidding.
So people have to walk through the streets with boots on, otherwise they get their feet wet. Just go look at a current picture of Venice during high tide, and you'll see it.
No kidding. Wow. Peter, you know, you're really explaining things that totally reverse what everybody has known about for years. That's incredible. How does that relate back to Job, though, that he was to look at the mountain?
This is a time of distress, okay?
Yes.
So we're seeing stresses on the Earth. An increased number of earthquakes. Here's an interesting statistic.
Yes.
In the last 15 years, the number of earthquakes has increased 700%.
Wow. Wow. And that's prophesied in the Bible, right? There'll be wars and rumors of war and earthquakes and floods and famine.
In one place after another. And these are the things that we are seeing. So when I realized... back in 35 years ago, when I realized the impact of this one single scripture in Job, it made me research the Bible from a scientific viewpoint, because I grew up with evolution on one side and creation on the other side, and neither the twain shall meet.
Right.
But there is a way that they meet. When you start to go through the book of Genesis, there are certain things that God does, that Yahweh commands, and it happens. And there are other times that he gives a command. He says, let such and such take place, or let this take place. And when you follow what geologists say about the formation of our universe, the formation of our Earth, you get to a point where we transfer from the Precambrian period into the Cambrian period. And here's the interesting thing.
Just a second, Peter. I usually have a break about this time, but, you know, we were delayed in starting, so we'll wait for the 40-minute time break so I can have you continue talking. Let me just give people the phone number where they can call in, because people can if they'd like to, and either call in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008 or 530-327-7602. 530-327-7602. Sorry, go ahead and tell us the difference between the Cambrian in Precambrian people.
Well, not people, but period. The Precambrian lasted about a billion years, and it started off with the formation of single-cell life forms, phytoplankton and zooplankton. It starts off really with cyanobacteria. And over a billion years, by the end of the billion years, the most sophisticated life form you have is basically a jellyfish. But
really?
Then you go into, so a billion years takes place.
Wow.
Then you
wow.
go into the Cambrian period, and all of a sudden there's an explosion of genetic information on this planet that has never been rivaled since. There's
wow.
only been a reduction in genetic information. Species have gone out of existence. It's tantamount to American Indians going to sleep on Manhattan Island 500 years ago and waking up to New York City being built around them.
Yes. Wasn't there a movie showing that, you know, the dinosaurs and all that inhabiting Manhattan, and then, of course, it became modern-day New York?
This would be an overnight process, and
wow.
scientists can't explain where all this genetic information came from. Well,
let's go
a little bit further into Genesis. In Genesis, the second chapter, I think it's about the 22nd verse, God says, "It's not good for the man to be alone. I'm going to make a helper for him." So he causes a sleep to fall over the man. He removes a rib, and he builds a woman out of this rib. Now, this sounds all very miraculous, and even but Adam gives us a clue here. He says, when he meets the woman, he says, "This is at last flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone," and Adam married his cloned twin sister. We would call the process genetic engineering.
Already, wow! Is that what you really think happened?
Well, you explain where all the DNA came from.
I have no idea, other than God put it on Earth, right?
Or somebody. You see, we get this information that, you know, religion says, "Oh, well, it's a holy mystery." No, there are no mysteries in science. There are only unanswered questions. And so that's what science is all about, is answering the unknown.
Yes.
And genetic engineering would explain the vast variety of life that we have. Now you say, "Oh, well, it all evolved." Well, yeah, okay, did it all happen by itself? In some cases, you have different varieties or different types of animals. But how do you get a dog evolving from the same genetic information as a chimpanzee does? When you go back far enough, they're going to merge together. When you get into the Jurassic period, where dinosaurs ruled the world, once they were snuffed out, only little mammals were left.
How come? Do you have any explanation for that?
Well, the scientists believe that the mammals were underground, and because they were small, they weren't impacted by a possible meteor strike on the Earth. But that wiped out the reptilians. But the mammals then, but what happens? What do? One mammal or one little group of mammals created all the diversity that we see in mammalia life on Earth? Not logical.
No, exactly.
But Ed, you know, we share 7% of the same DNA as a daisy.
You know, like when I say we're all part of one another, that's the reason, huh? All of us have some genetic material that's the same.
So you just keep on adding in more genetic information, you create more different species, and it's a totally logical explanation for life on Earth. It was genetically engineered.
But let me ask you, and, you know, I've read your book, which I love, by the way. People, you've got to get it. Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon. How come then there is no life in any other place in the universe? Why only here? If it came here, couldn't it go anywhere else?
Well, here's the interesting thing. We know we live in the third dimension, but until string theory, we didn't know that any other dimensions existed. And then when you work out the in order for us to be here in the three-dimensional world, there needs to be seven other dimensions to support us. Now let's look at the biblical. Yeah. Now let's look at what the Bible says. Well, it's a matter of mathematics. In order for us to exist, there needs to be seven other spatial dimensions. If they weren't there, we wouldn't be here.
Can you tell us what they are? Do you know what these other spatial dimensions are?
Not really. One of them is time. It's actually seven plus time. Time's a dimension in itself, but scientists are kind of at a loss. There are little dimensions that are curled up, some of them residing within ourselves and within the space that we occupy. And then it goes on. That string theory, M theory, says it doesn't have to stop there. There could be an infinite number of dimensions.
Wow.
Now, we have to look at, is there only life in the three-dimensional world that we live in? And the question is, the answer is highly unlikely, because the possibilities are open to the extreme.
Well, you know, spiritually speaking, you know, I am a seer, I am a prophet, and I see into the spiritual dimension, you know, which would be the fourth, fifth, or whatever. And I can guarantee you that there are beings in those other dimensions, both good and bad.
I had an interesting situation happen. I was bringing my son home from college.
Yeah.
And this is really strange. I had just set the cruise control for 63 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And within about 30 seconds after I set the cruise control, my son was fiddling with the CD player. I looked down, pointed to the button he needed to push. And when I looked up, a deer had jumped out of the tree line and then went to jump across the road. And as it's in midair, I mean, we're ready to impact. As it's in midair, a blue orb came out of nowhere and got between myself and the deer. The deer, this was a big deer. I figured its live weight was about 250 pounds.
Wow.
This deer went across the whole windshield of the car. It impacted the car, it bounced off, oddly enough. I thought it was going to come through the window. I figured we were dead.
Oh, my God.
It bounced off. I stopped. I looked at it. I was like, what did I just see? My mind had trouble comprehending what I just saw, what had just happened.
An angelic intervention.
That's all. When I get out of the car to look at the damage, my thought was, did I just see the hand of God?
You sure did. You know, go ahead, Peter. Go ahead.
The deer landed in the ditch back about, 50 yards behind the car. My son ran back to check on the deer. He said the deer got up and pranced off like it was proud.
Wow. Like nothing happened to it.
Like nothing happened.
Oh, my God.
And when you look at the windshield of the car, now this orb was a blue orb that appeared. It was about the size of a grapefruit, and it blew up like a balloon.
Wow.
And when you look at the windshield of the car, there's a 3-foot round depression in the glass.
Wow. Wow. So, you know, it hit there, but somehow was diverted by supernatural force. And, you know, we're coming up to a time now, Peter, that people are being taken up to the fourth and fifth dimension and higher, you know, because our Earth, have you heard about that? The Earth is moving much faster, rotating faster. And I know a few years ago I read that we were actually losing 2 weeks a year in the Greenwich clock. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard some, I've read some things, but I haven't seen enough scientific evidence, and there wouldn't necessarily be any, because this is one of those things that they're going to want to cover up. I've noticed that the moon sets in a different place, the sun sets in a different place.
Really? What do you mean?
Well, when my son actually asked me this a couple of years ago, he said, do you notice that the moon isn't setting where it used to? And he's noticed where the moon used to set off the back of his house as it would go down on the tree line, and where it sets now, it actually appears to have moved. So there are Earth changes that are going on that we're not being made aware of, because that would give too much significance to the things which are yet to come.
Wow. Tell me what you know about the things that are yet to come, from your research and knowledge of the Bible.
Well, we're living in a transition period right now. The end times, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
And what is happening now, we are actually in a fight over the right to rule the third dimension. And now here's an interesting, the whole theme of the Bible is the forces of good and evil.
Exactly.
we have these stories of Satan or Lucifer, if you'd like, who deceived the first couple, had their, and now here's an interesting thing. People say, oh, the story about the fruit is just a story. Well, what if that apple or fruit, that forbidden fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, had a virus which erased part of our genetic code?
That's what you were saying. Can you explain what you really mean by that and who put it there to be like that?
Well, here's the thing. If God created everything or had everything created to his specifications, and there was no knowledge of good and evil, we didn't have that choice of one way or the other, but there was the only thing that was forbidden was the eating of this fruit. You must not touch it. So you got to give man a challenge.
But why? If God is perfect, as we know he is, why would he create something or allow something to be created that's imperfect?
Well, you see, good point. And humans weren't created imperfect. When you go back to the story of the Sumerians and the Anunnaki, they make the claim that they genetically engineered us. Well, they genetically deformed us is what actually happened.
That would be the precursors of Satan's representative. Is that who you mean by Anunnaki?
Well, it actually comes after that. This is the story. Zacharias Sitchin did a lot of work on this with the first text that were given to the ancient Babylonians or Sumerians. Yes. And this is actually where religion and government comes in as means to control the people.
Wow.
If you go back, we don't have enough time in the show to go through the whole situation, but I do explain it in Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon.
Yes.
If you go back to those, to the origination of religion and government, it brings you right back to the ancient Sumerians and their involvement with the Anunnaki, these gods that came from another place, perhaps another dimension. Now, we're told that, if you're an alien believer, we're told that, oh, aliens come from different parts of the galaxy because, you know, they don't believe that they are, that there's not that truthfulness of life forms in another dimension. But here's the thing. Whatever that blue orb was instantly appeared. It came out of another dimension. It didn't come floating in. It instantly appeared in our dimension.
Exactly. You know, like I say, Peter, you know, I'm not only a retired judge, but I am a prophet and a minister, and I've ministered all over the country. And, you know, I've always sought for God, you know, always searched, which is what led me to believe in Jesus in my life. And I have seen demons, and I have seen at least parts of angels, and I've had some amazing miraculous happenings. So we cannot deny the spiritual dimension of our life. But as you say, we have a war, right, between God's spirituality and the demonic spirituality. And, you know, what really saddens me is how easily and quickly people go to what is really of Satan and how deceived they get. And you point that in your book as well, right? Do you have any comment about that?
Well, let's take a look at life itself. When a child is born, somebody raised this question on my Facebook page, and I'll mention everybody. If you want to follow me on Facebook, just look up Peter Kling, become a friend. I've got room there, so there's no problem. There's about 3,000 people that are paying attention to what I have to say right now, so join the crowd. It'll be beneficial. K-L-I-N-G.
And the first name, Peter, like the
right
apostle.
Right.
Okay, go ahead, please.
But this one person wrote that she didn't believe that there was any unconditional love on the earth, that we did not have unconditional love for each other. And there really is unconditional love. It's the unconditional love between a mother and her child. That child, mother or father, will always have unconditional love for the parents. But as they grow up, what do? We sit them in front of the idiot box, and then they can start to absorb all the evil of this world. They get to see murders. They get to see war. They get to see how to shoot and kill people. They get to see the injustice of this world. And those are very impressionable little minds. And they start absorbing all of this. And then they start imitating it. And so from from infancy almost, we inculcate in their hearts and in their minds that it's okay, that these are acceptable behaviors. And then with the breakdown in the family that we've seen over the past 50 years, husband and wife argue back and forth, they battle, I'm not going to put up with this anymore, I want a divorce. Right. And then you see the family breakdown, and the child says, what did I do to cause this?
Yes.
And so that leaves scars on children.
Do you notice, though, how all that immorality and bad pictures and bad messages have increased so much in the past 30 or 40 years? We really didn't have so many bad movies or TV shows as we do now. And I know you talk about it, too, and I wanted to touch upon the Protocols of Zion and who's really behind all what's going on in the world, you know, partly the Illuminati and all those groups.
Let's go back. I'm going to point out one scripture within Acts. It's Acts 7, 42 and 43. And this is interesting. Yes. It's the disciple Stephen quoting the prophet Amos. And he's standing before the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish high court in the first century.
Right.
And I'm going to paraphrase it here. Stephen is talking to the high priest, and he says, was it to me, O Israel, to whom you worshiped those 40 years in the wilderness? No, it was to Molech and the star god Raphan to whom you worshiped. And for that, I will send you far away beyond Babylon. Now, in 607 or around 607 B.C., that's pretty much what happened. Israel was captured by Babylon and taken out of their homeland. It was left desolate.
Right. Right.
And in the first century, Rome came in. They surrounded the city in 70, General Titus did. They put almost 2 million Jews to the sword. Josephus said that the blood was running in the streets thick enough to, or deep enough to put out fires. And the Romans took captive about 90,000 Jews, took them captive back to Rome as
to
slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is most of the Jewish population bought themselves out of slavery before the end of the first century. But let's take a look at what Stephen said. He said, was it to me, O Israel, whom you worshiped those 40 years in the wilderness? Well, now, this was the group of people that was liberated from Egyptian bondage. They were liberated at Nisan 14, about 1513 BCE.
Wow. Let me just say we're going to a break at this moment, so I cannot wait to hear the rest of what you have to say, Peter. And I want you to talk about Prince William. You and I have been on the show together, and I didn't think that what you said was so, but I need to hear what you have to say.
We'll tie it all together on the other side of the break.
Wonderful. Thank you, Peter.
Hello, this is Judge Eve Ellingwood, known also as Cohen Sternlight. I'm so glad to be on bbsradio.com every other Saturday, like this Saturday, June 2nd. I have a website, www.90210holocaust.com. That's HOLOCAUST.com. The story of my parents' murder in Beverly Hills by my brother and sister and the theft of their millions. I've written a couple of books, but one of them is available on the website as an e-book, Diary of Sober Faith in Action. Also, I am a prophet, I am a seer, and I am a healer, and if people are interested, I can set up appointments to help people for a fee, and it will depend on what's involved and what has to be done. And to reach me, you can reach me by my email, eejudgeeve79@gmail.com. That's E like elephant, E like elephant, J U D like David, G like George, E like elephant, E like elephant, V for victory, E like elephant, 79@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you and hearing what else you would like to hear on the show and what help you might need. Also, legally, especially for people who are unemployed, I can help. I cannot give specific advice, but I can help. Maybe also political issues and other legal issues and spiritual issues. Thank you. Look forward to hearing from you. Thank you. Hello, everybody. Back again with our wonderful guest,
Mr. Peter Kling, who wrote Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon. You can obtain the book on his website, which is www.peterkling.com. Also Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And Peter, please go ahead and continue what you were telling us.
Well, we can actually follow this story out of Egypt.
Yes.
And Egypt is still ruling us today. Let's just take
really?
A look at your money. Pyramid on one side. When you flip it over, you take a dollar bill. There's that pyramid with the all-seeing eye.
Yes.
Flip it back over to where you can see Washington and go up to the upper right-hand corner.
Yes.
Where the one symbol, where the number one is, and you can see in the border around the one, right where it kind of curves to the left, there's a little
yes.
owl sitting there.
Oh,
Molech.
I have
has
never
been,
seen that. Molech
yes.
is the owl god, right?
Yeah, well, Molech actually started off as a bull's head with a man, and he required a man's body, and he required live child sacrifice.
I get goosebumps. Oh, my God, you're kidding.
So here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
This same religious cult, which was prevalent in Egypt, became
yes.
prevalent in Israel and is prevalent today. It's never ended. Now, let's take a look at what happened after the Jews were taken into Rome. They assimilated
yes.
themselves into European society.
Yes.
And 1,000 years later, we have the Holy Wars. And what was the prime directive of the Holy Wars? To recapture Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, right.
And
oh,
so now you get yeah. the Knights Templar that goes back to Jerusalem. And
yes.
again, they put everyone to the sword. They killed everyone, Christian, Jew, Muslim, man, woman, and child. They decimated.
Why?
No,
Why,
they didn't
Peter?
Decimate. They exterminated the whole city.
Oh
well, what did they do next? They started digging. And what were they looking for? Well, we don't actually know. We know that
yeah.
they certainly found documents. They may have found a stash of gold. They may have found who knows what. But we know that all of a sudden, throughout these holy wars, the next 300 years, Europe was transformed into buildings of wood to buildings of stone.
Why?
Well, they had the money, they had the knowledge, they had the technology, which was all buried under the Temple Mount.
So something happened. What do you think was the cause of having those documents in Jerusalem?
Well, I believe that the reigning class of Jerusalem buried them when the Roman armies came in and laid siege to the city. And they were there. Because the Ark of the Covenant disappeared prior to the Babylon's destruction of Jerusalem in 607.
Really? Yes.
But they had to know. They had to know enough to go back and search for something. How did they
yes.
know? Unless it was handed down from generation to generation to go back to the Temple Mount and start digging, looking for the secret knowledge that was buried.
Wow.
If you look at the history of the royals of Europe,
yes.
there's a lot of involvement between the royals and the hierarchy of the Jewish people. There's a lot of involvement.
All of them, even though they're not Jewish? Is that what you're saying? Like the English? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, if you look at their history, there is a relationship between the royals and the Hebrews, or
wow.
say it, the Jews. And it goes back, it just dawned on me, and I lost it here. There's a movie that was done back in the late 50s, which kind of brought this out. I'll think of the movie in a little bit. But it's an interesting historic account. It goes back to the same time of the Crusades, and it shows the relationship between the royals and the Hebrews at the time.
Kidding me? You know, I've read it, and may I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
You know, when Prince William and Kate got married, you know, which I just loved, I thought it was wonderful, they played the song Jerusalem at the church. Did you happen to observe the wedding or watch it?
I'm not a big royals watcher, but Kate does have Hebrew roots.
How do you know that?
Through research.
I get goosebumps.
for research.
Oh, my God. And why were they playing that song, now that you're mentioning the those connection between the royals and the Jews? My goodness. Yeah. What is going on, Peter?
Mm-hmm. Look at the royal crest. Look at the crest of the House of Windsor. What do you see there? The Lion of Judah.
The Lion of Judah. Is that why it's there? Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
What's the other thing?
Is that a unicorn?
A unicorn, and it's interesting. The unicorn has a chain on it, and the unicorn symbolizes Israel.
Why? I've never heard that before.
Well, you can go on Google, do the research. It's there. So there's this relationship between this reigning class that was taken captive out of Israel and assimilated into the European society. Now, they're not Jewish per se, or they're not Hebrew per se. Yes. They're Zionists. They're the worshippers of Molech.
Oh, you know, let me tell you something. You know, being born in Jerusalem, you know, when it was still Palestine, it, of course, to me, the Zionist movement was to get the people who were persecuted, you know, by the Nazis to have a safe place. And my grandpa, my wonderful, wonderful father's father, my blonde grandpa with the blue eyes whose beard I used to braid when I was little, his name was Herzl, you know, which is the father of Zionism. So how do I relate the good Zionists with the bad Zionists?
Well, you really can't, because Zionism is like the front, it's the window of the store. And this is not an anti-Semitic statement.
I have
quite a few friends that were Jewish. As a matter of fact, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood.
I think you're part Jewish. You know, God always shows me who is part Jewish. But go ahead, Peter.
if you looked at my grandmother, you would think so. here's the interesting thing. I like to relate this story. As a child, I used to cut the lawn. My parents were good friends with this family who were Jewish. They were Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
And I remember we were invited over for dinner there, and it was a great dinner. You had Christian, Jew, and Persian all at the same table eating dinner.
Wow.
You had three different religions represented. They had a woman who was their governess taking care of their children, and she was from Iran. As a matter of fact, my younger sister, her middle name, she was named after this woman.
Wow.
So, and here we all got along. I mean, it was great. You know, everyone was friendly. And that's really the way it should be, because when you look at it, all three religions claim to worship the same God, yet if you look at what's going on in the world, they hate each other. They want to kill each other. Why?
You know, I was raised with the Arabs. There was no problem. It was, you know, when the leaders became a problem is when the problem started, you know. So why? Why? Why is there a problem?
Well, the problem is that if you can turn around, and I think that this really came about in the Second World War through the Holocaust.
Yeah.
For some reason, the common people, and even Jesus said this, he said that this is a people that are battered and bruised, and he blamed the ruling class of Israel for it. He said, you only give them the scraps. You don't feed them properly. You only give them the scraps. He was talking in a spiritual manner.
Right.
And that's pretty much the same today. In my book, I wrote that the nation of Israel or the Jewish people have been used as cannon fodder by the Zionists.
Oh, my. And that's why they had him killed, I know, in by Hitler. So there would be Israel set up, you know, from what I understand, you know.
When you look into Hitler's background, it's very possible that he has Rothschild roots.
I know that. Isn't that, and you know, all of Israel is named after Rothschild. And would you believe when we were in Jerusalem, I went to a school called Evelina de Rothschild. It was a Jewish school, very Orthodox. We had to pray, but we also learned English. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how did I get into this? But, Peter, we only have a few minutes. And please tell the world why you think Prince William is what you're going to say that he is.
Well, here's an interesting thing. Let's go back to Diana. His mother, very beautiful woman. She was, when she was alive, she was one of the two most popular women in the world. It was her and Sister Teresa. I think one of the classic pictures is her meeting Sister Teresa. That's been published all over the place. And Diana was loved by the world. Yes. And so here you have a very beautiful woman, and she was sacrificed. If you look at where she died, it was at the 13th pillar on the Bridge of Souls, and it was actually under a monument. I forget what the monument's name is, but it was a monument to the goddess of the moon.
Wow.
So it's interesting the location that she was actually sacrificed. But she gave her genes to William, and so now William is the prodigy. But if you look at the situation, now he's been handled naturally by the court of England or the throne, and he has the right to become king.
Yeah.
The world would not follow Prince Charles, but they would follow William. They look to him as a younger version of Diana. He's got Diana's looks. It's the same loving face that they see that Diana had. The interesting thing is when you start doing research on William, he has a dark side.
Oh, now, really?
Well,
what?
Well, I'm not going to go. It's more related into pictures. There's an interesting, outstanding picture where he is holding a lamb.
Yeah.
But what is interesting, he's holding one of the cloven hoofs of the lamb.
Oh, my God.
So. If we are pushed into a one-world government or a new world order, and this is something that we all have to pay attention to, out of the White House we have seen edicts, essentially, presidential proclamations, which have gone contrary to the law of the land or the Constitution, where now the government has the right to arrest and detain you without habeas corpus, where they also have the right to come in and utilize anything that you have for their benefit.
Yes.
So right now, if we were in a time, the government literally has the right to come in and take everything that you own.
Wow.
Without explanation.
And you see, that's what you were saying. I know. And see, a lot of it I know, too. And we have to watch and be prepared. You know, I knew about concentration camps in the United States for over 20, 30 years. And my mother would say, oh, no, no, no. And I would say, Mommy, you have to think good, but you have to prepare for the bad. And many of her friends were concentration camp survivors, and they told me about 15 years ago, Eve, we're seeing here in the United States exactly what we saw in Nazi Germany before we were taken to the camps.
Peter, I want to sum this up really quick. What we're seeing here is the prelude to a one-world government. We're being set up for rule by a central location. And that is all foretold in the book of Revelation, where it talks about a wild beast, the image of a wild beast, which causes everyone to worship it. And if they don't worship it, the wild beast will kill them.
Yeah.
But then this wild beast turns around and destroys religion. Now, if religion is destroyed, there'll be people rioting in the streets. And when that happens, those concentration camps will fill up overnight.
Wow.
However, we go for a little further into Revelation, and it gives a very interesting statement in Revelation, the 19th chapter. It says the King of Kings and Lord of Lords is coming with the armies of heaven, or the armies of the multiverse.
Amen.
And so we are going to see the final conflict where these armies, and it's interesting when you go down, I believe it's around the 17th verse, it says who the army is targeting. And it starts off with the rulers of this world, the military men, and those who support this paradigm. And so we're ready to go into this shift here. And the whole thing is we can survive it if we know what to do. And one of the biggest, most important things that we are told to do is in the greatest commandment, to love Yahweh your God with your whole heart, soul, and mind. Now, God or Yahweh is not some old man that rides around on a cloud that likes to listen to harp music. Yahweh is the actual, I'll give you a quick definition. If you can, in the Bible it says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. Before me there was nothing, and after me there will be nothing. Well, if you cannot create nor destroy energy, but only change its form, then at one time, before anything else existed, there could only be pure dynamic energy in the most pure state. And we know that that energy was conscious, because had a conscious and could think, because we have a conscious and can think. Or we are conscious and can think. So now the question is, what turned this energy into what we call God or Yahweh?
Yes.
And it can only be one thing.
What?
This energy came up with the concept of love.
Yes.
Something you can never give away completely. The more you give, the better you feel. The more you get, the better you feel. And it works on so many different levels. You can love your dog. You can love your kids. You can love your parents. You can love your car. You can love your house. You can love that significant other in your life.
Yes.
It never ends.
That's wonderful, Peter. I do have to close the show, though, and I want to thank you so much for being with us. Peter Kling, the Einstein of Biblical Prophecy, his book, Letters to Earth, You Can Survive Armageddon, and you can get it on his website, www.peterkling.com. Thank you. God bless you, Peter. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Have a blessed day, and bye-bye now. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom, shalom, shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom, shalom, shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom, shalom, shalom aleichem. Hava, nagila, hava, nagila, hava, nagila venismecha. Hava, nagila, hava, nagila, hava, nagila venismecha. Hava, neranena, hava, neranena, hava, neranena, venismecha. Hava, neranena, hava, neranena, hava, neranena, venismecha. Uru achim, uru achim belesameach, uru achim belesameach, uru achim belesameach, uru achim belesameach, uru achim, uru achim belesameach. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm honored to have Mr. Barry Farber with me on the show. He's known as the pioneer of conservative radio talk shows. So honored by Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. He is a writer, a journalist, a nationally syndicated talk show host, an Army veteran. He's someone who speaks 26 languages, and I can't wait to hear about that. In 1991, he was won the title of Talk Show Host of the Year, and he was recently named among the top 10 radio talk show hosts of all time by Talkers Magazine. And in 2007, he was given the George Washington Award by the American Hungarian Foundation for his work in helping Hungarian refugees during the Cold War. And he's conservative, and I love it because I'm a Reaganite. Shalom, 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 Mr. Farber. How are you?
Shalom. Good to be talking to you, Your Honor. A genuine honor for me.
Thank you. It's an honor for me. I was going to say to you, I'm a Yerushalmi Tzabra. Do you know what that means?
No. Really?
I'm a Tzabra.
You were born in Israel?
Oh, yes. It was Palestine at the time. I was there during the War of Independence. You bet. You know, my father had a furniture store in the daytime, and at night he would work for the Haganah. You know,
so
we were under...
So, Ahmed Ivrit?
Oh, my
Lord. The judge talks Hebrew like she's paid by the word.
You know something? When I speak English and I'm taped, I hear my Hebrew accent, even though I've been here for many, many years. Isn't that funny? I want to tell you, I want everybody first to know that you've recently come up with this wonderful book called Cocktails with Molotov. And for people, I'll give the one place where they can get it, WND.com. But, Mr. Farber, can you tell them where else they can get your book?
Cocktails with Molotov is sort of out and around. I would say that my best, shortest answer is Amazon.
Amazon, okay.
I'm Hebrew is not among the languages I speak well. My Yiddish is much better. And I'm studying Hebrew now. But there's one. May I give you one little short story from Cocktails with Molotov?
I saw that about the doggy. Yes.
What you said so far.
I want to hear it.
I was in an elevator one day in my apartment building, and there was a man talking to a dog, and I can recognize Hebrew, and he was speaking Hebrew to the dog. And I said, is that Hebrew you're speaking to that dog? And he said, yes. And it was a slow elevator. I said, teach me some dog Hebrew. And he said, Bohena. That's how you yell. You have to know the gender of a dog in Hebrew before you tell him to quit biting you. Well, 3 weeks later, I was in that same elevator again.
Yes.
And it was the same dog, but a different grown-up with the dog. And that dog looked at me as if to say, okay, dude, how much do you remember? And all I remembered was one Hebrew dog word, but I forgot what it meant. But I looked at him, I looked at that dog, I figured, what I got to lose? And I said, Chev. And sure enough, the dog sat. And then I remembered that Chev means sit. Now, a lot of Jewish boys learn Hebrew from the rabbi. Many Jewish boys, more than you would expect, learn Hebrew from Catholic priests and others who are schooled in biblical languages. But I'm the only Jewish boy you ever heard of who had to depend on the meaning of a Hebrew word formed from an Israeli dog.
I love it. You know what you said to those who don't speak Hebrew? Bohena means come here. Letayel means to go for a walk or for, you know, a little recreational. And Shev means sit. You're absolutely right. And I have to say, Mr. Farber, I have just about every page in your book folded up as an interesting story. So let me ask you this first. Was this intended to be like your biography in a humorous way?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. No, quite different. My autobiography would have too many dull pages.
Also, I
didn't consider anything like a memoir because I don't think I've done that much worth memoiring.
I decided to take
stories from my life that had to have two qualifications.
Yes.
They have to be stomped down 100% true.
Yes.
And to some extent, unbelievable. Now, take the title, Cocktails with Molotov. That is a little unbelievable for a Jewish boy from North Carolina. But
it's amazing. And you know, when I first saw
Molotov,
the title?
Vyacheslav Molotov, the real one, who wrote the von Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact with the late Adolf Hitler's foreign minister.
That's what you were saying.
I'm the only living witness of a fight between Joan Crawford and Betty Davis.
I want to hear that one because you talked.
I went from the University of North Carolina to the University of Maryland to see a football game and wound up for 6 weeks in communist Yugoslavia. I'm not adding anything. I'm not taking anything out. I went from one college for a football game to another college, wound up for 6 weeks in Yugoslavia. That's the only kind of story that I would put into the book. 100% true. And at least to some extent, unbelievable.
And what I'd like to talk about is your chapter about the honor. You know how you talked about honor in Southern style? Do you remember that story?
Oh, could you really identify with that? I'm so
very
glad.
I lived in Charleston, South Carolina when we first came to the United States, so I understand.
I have to tell you, forgive me, Judge, for rearranging the order of this court proceeding,
Please.
But I got to tell you first about Charlie Fawcett from Charleston, South Carolina, an Episcopalian aristocrat who married and divorced six Jewish women within 18 months.
Mr. Fawcett,
who saved their lives.
Go ahead, tell us the story. It's amazing. It's just amazing.
Well, briefly, he was studying in Paris.
Yes.
And World War II came, and the Germans took Paris. Hitler did not want any trouble with America at that time.
Yeah.
So he passed the word along, treat the Americans in France correctly.
How do you know that, by the way?
Students, and they want to keep studying, let them keep studying.
Yes.
When word of that got down from Berlin to the French underground in Paris, there was a knock on Charlie's dormitory door.
Yes.
And the representative of the French underground said, Mr. Fawcett, could you help us save some lives? You're an American. If you were to marry and divorce as many Jewish women as the calendar gives us time to permit, then every one of those women will become Mrs. Charlie Fawcett, and they will get papers to go from Hitler's world to America. from the instead of the gas chambers to America.
Yes.
He said, well, sure, I'll be happy to help. He didn't need all six. It was all done through paperwork by some very courageous and disobedient people at the American Embassy in Paris. They, the American State Department was not in the business of saving individual Jews.
You know,
at
you
time.
Said they were anti-Semitic, you know, which really amazed me. Are you saying the people in the State Department in America were anti-Semitic at the time?
Well, they, let's put it this way, their priority at that time was staying out of it. And after December the 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and Hitler declared war on us 5 days later, at that point our priority, they would say, is winning World War II. They would never admit they were anti-Semitic. But I think you and I understand each other.
Of course, I do. But go ahead and...
About Southern honor, shall I get to that now? Because I love that story, because this thing is almost dead. It's almost gone.
And that's why I appreciate you telling it. You know, our world has changed so much, and I love the old honor and manners and good behavior by people. So please, please, please tell us about the Southern honor.
I guess as a judge, you spent most of your life hearing about the other side. Well, I lived in New York, and there was a press club in North Carolina who wanted me to come and take part in one of their panels.
Yes.
And I did not want to go. I was very busy. I worked very hard during the week. I had an all-night radio show in New York. I kept more people up nights than Mexican food. And I wanted to rest during the weekends. I didn't want to go gallivanting off to something that I had no interest in.
Yes.
And they kept calling me, and they kept importuning me, and they just wore me down. And finally I said, okay.
Yes.
Now, when I got to the airport that Saturday morning, I realized that what I thought was a plane that left at 9:52 really left at 9:25, and I had missed it. Now, I'm not slamming the North. I love the North, but I can tell you right now, Your Honor, a Northerner would have picked up the phone and said, you're not going to believe this because you know I didn't want to come. I'm at the airport. I'm at LaGuardia Airport. I missed a plane. There's no way for me to get to Charlotte by 1 p.m. I just want you to know that's true, and I'm sorry. Have a good panel. Goodbye. No, that would not do for a Southerner. I had to make that call, but I had to make it with both feet on the soil of North Carolina. There was a flight to Raleigh. Raleigh is nowhere near Charlotte.
Right.
Raleigh is as far as the Dead Sea is from the Lebanese border. From Charlotte. So,
that's funny.
But I got on that plane so that I could make that call from the Raleigh, North Carolina airport, where it would have more credibility. So I could say to the people in Charlotte, I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm going to hang up. Here's my number. And they would see from the area code that wherever I were, it was North Carolina. You understand?
I sure do.
And sure enough, they called me. And I said, look, I tried. And but they said, well, why did you take the plane to Raleigh if there's no way to get here? I said, so you would believe that I really tried. Well, you know, in Greek Greek drama, they have what they call deus ex machina. That means God comes out of a machine and fixes everything.
Here, I didn't know that.
As I was walking back to catch the plane back to New York, the loudspeaker says, if anybody wants a taxi plane to Charlotte, there's one waiting at gate 2. It was the first small plane I'd ever been in. The pilot took my bag and put it in the wing. It was the first time I could ever see the runway taken off the landing. So I made it. I made it and lived happily ever after, or at least honorably ever after.
You sure did. And, you know, not only that, but God wanted you to be there, so he arranged for you to make it no matter what happened.
I have no difficulty with that. I believe that.
By the way, I want to tell you something. My mother was Sarah, S-A-R-A, and I was very touched by your story about your Sarah.
Oh, don't tell me she didn't have an H on it?
No. Isn't that unusual?
Oh, my Sarah doesn't have an H on it either.
Exactly, and that's what I noticed. And do you want to talk about that a little bit, or do you want to talk about your other story?
In 1969, this woman came to apply for a job. Yes. I was big dog in the all-night meat house on WOR rate. I was 28% of WOR's entire broadcast
week. Wow. Wow.
And I was a single man. This beautiful woman walked in, and I wanted to marry her on the spot, but we got along like a slow waiter and a poor tipper. She didn't smile, and she didn't want the job. And about a year and a half later, we met again. Yes. She was by that time a television reporter. She was probably the first female television reporter for a major television station in a major market. It was Channel 5 in New York.
Wow.
And we met again a year and a half later, and again, she didn't give me what Jimmy Durante called the big hello. She didn't smile. So I forgot all about her. 37 years later, I saw her name in an email copied to a mutual friend.
Yes.
I emailed him immediately. I said, is this the same Sarah Pence who used to be on Channel 5 in New York?
Yes.
Affirmative. So he booked my email over to Sarah, and Sarah wrote me a nice email, and I wrote her a nicer email. And we ping-ponged back and forth by email for about 2 years, and we were married September the 3rd, 2008, in the Orange County, California courthouse in Santa Ana.
Congratulations. And
newlyweds at this age.
Isn't that wonderful? And you're happy together, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, my parents were from Poland, so I like to say I'm Polish, and I'm not very good in telling jokes. And I noticed how in some of your storytelling, you talk about the Polish not exactly being the smartest people in the world. Do you have any comment about that?
I'm sorry. I dropped the phone. The Polish what?
My parents, you know, Jewish, but Polish, from Poland, right? So you had some stories about how some of the Polish people were not exactly the smartest, but they did conquer some places. I'm trying to remember which story that was.
Well, funny, I didn't realize I had that in the book, but, you know, you remind me of the very first ethnic joke I ever heard.
Yes.
It was a Polish joke.
Yes.
But it was a pro-Polish joke.
Oh, good.
You know, there were young Polish men outside Poland who were able to join Polish armies of resistance. There were entire Polish units of the British commandos. And when the Germans that they raided on the coast of France prior to Normandy learned that they were facing Poles, they were as terrified as the Germans in Italy later learned when they were facing Jews from the Jewish Brigade of the British Eighth Army, which you're probably familiar with, having been born in Israel. Well, there was a story of the Poles, a Polish paratroop brigade attached to the British Army.
Yes.
It's not a very funny joke, but I found it very touching. And the briefing officer said, now we're going to go in at 800 feet. You're barely going to have enough time to open your parachutes. And one of the Polish soldiers' eyes got real wide. He said, you mean we're going to get parachutes? In other words, they were so imbued with patriotism and hatred of the late Adolf Hitler that to them the issue of parachutes was irrelevant. We're going to get to jump on the Germans. That's all they thought.
But you know something? That's something my mother would do and I would do.
Absolutely.
I'm not a very good joke teller, but I have to tell you this because it's the only one I really can tell well. This Polish guy goes to his car, and he sees that he left the keys in the car. So he doesn't know what to do. The car is locked, and he goes and he finds a policeman, and he says, can you please help me? I'd like my keys in the car. The policeman goes with him to the car, and the policeman starts laughing. So the Polish guy says, why are you laughing? The policeman says, you have the convertible, and the top is down.
Oh, dear. No.
What can I tell you?
But, you know, I'll tell you a true story that happened in that regard. Somebody went to a very well-known mechanic shop in New York City, and he had when they finished the job, they had his own keys locked in the car, not his fault, and there he was in a hurry to get away. And a mechanic went out and and was working on the on the driver's side door.
Yes.
Well, the guy noticed that the passenger side door was open. He said, wait a minute, look, The door is open. He said, oh, I know, I got that one, but now I'm working on this one. So you don't have to be Polish to generate jokes like that.
Isn't that funny? You know, another thing that amazed me, you know, when you talk about Norway and how the Norwegian, they were not in sympathy with the Nazis, but they worked in collaboration with them. Do you remember that?
Oh, the Norwegians.
The Finnish?
Let's face it. It was not like they told us during the war.
Oh.
We had propaganda, too. They told us that every Pole was anti-Nazi, every Belgian was anti-Nazi, every Dane was anti-Nazi. Good Lord, they even told us every Austrian was anti-Nazi, and they were enthusiastic Nazis of all. But,
wow.
I mean, Norway gave us the word for traitor, Quisling. Quisling was the traitor who gave Norway to Adolf Hitler. But by and large, now that it's all over, the Norwegian, and I can prove this in your courtroom, Your Honor, the Norwegian people were freedom fighters for their own country. They were anti-Nazis, and the reason I can prove that is Adolf Hitler officially gave up on them. He invited them to be blonde, blue-eyed members of his Nordic New Order, but there were so many acts of sabotage that he canceled that and just made them plain old occupied countries Poland and Greece and Yugoslavia. As a matter of fact, there's a chapter in my book. When I wrote it, he was alive. He died just a few days ago. My favorite terrorist, and that was the leader
Norwegian
of the Norwegian
guy.
Underground, Gunnar Sundstedt.
Yes, I read that.
Whenever he would go to blow up a Nazi installation,
he
would make sure to get to a payphone. There were no cell phones yet.
Yes.
And he would call a number that he knew was like the receptionist inside that building, the Nazi German receptionist.
Right.
And he would say, this is number 424 from the Norwegian underground. Your building is going to blow up in 5 minutes. And he sometimes positioned himself where he could see these slightly overweight German sergeants carrying filing boxes and everything out as fast as they could. And he never disappointed them. The building always blew up. And I said, Gunnar, you were fighting for your country's survival. Why did you spare the Germans?
Yes.
He said, look, Barry, a few more dead Germans, more or less, would not have hastened Norway's liberation. He said, the only reason we did our activities at that stage of the war was to show the Norwegian people we were there, to show our Nazi occupiers, the enemy, we were there, and to show the Americans and British we were there, and we were worth sending explosives and ammunition to.
Wow.
He said, a few more dead Germans would not have made any difference. So that may have been the olden days, 1940 to 1945, but that's why I called him my favorite terrorist.
I know. I love that. What I want to repeat again is the name of the book. It's Cocktails with Molotov by Mr. Barry Farber, and it's available on Amazon and everywhere else books are sold, and also WND.com. And let me say again that I'm so honored to speak with you, Mr. Farber, because you are the pioneer, right, of conservative radio talk.
Naima, toda rava.
Naima, you very, the bakasha.
Lord, what a pleasure to meet a judge who can speak Hebrew.
Oh, thank you. What can I tell you? You know, I was, what touched me about your book, because I know so many of the situations that you talk about, you know, Second World War. What amazes me, too, is how did you keep repeatedly going to Yugoslavia and Hungary and maybe even Albania, although you met the king of Albania. Why did you end up going to those countries repeatedly?
Everyone had a different reason. I helped the Hungarians get out of Hungary into Austria. We helped them cross the border canal.
Wow.
And my best friend, I didn't put him in the book, and I want to start my next book with his story.
Good.
Best friend, my best male friend in life, is the only member of the North Korean Communist Army that fought the South Koreans to become an American citizen.
Wow.
He defected all the way across. You know that he was a star student, star soldier, and star communist, and they picked the best of the best. and they sent him from North Korea all the way across the Soviet Union, all the way to Hungary to study military engineering. When the Hungarian Revolution started, the Chinese communist students stayed in their dormitories, but the Hungarians came out and supported the freedom fight.
When he
married the Hungarian woman who brought him across the border, but there was a price on his head until communism fell in Hungary in 1991. And when his mother-in-law died in Budapest, I had no choice but to go. I promised I would never go and pay one penny to the regime that made their own citizens walk across landmines and through ice fields.
Drugged
their
Hungary?
Children with Nembutal so they wouldn't cry out in large groups and betray their location to the communist police. But I figured there was a higher moral of, and back to morality again, back to honor. I had to go and speak at his mother-in-law's funeral in Budapest. Yes. So that's how I got there. And Albania, I just fell in love. By the way, every Jew in the world should fall to his knees and thank Albania. Albania was the only country in the war where there were more Jews after the war than before, and it was a Nazi ally.
Wow.
But they hated the Germans. When they learned that foreigners from Germany were in Albania demanding that the Albanians turn over their own people who happened to be Jewish, they went nuts, and word came down from the elders in the mountains, don't you dare turn one single Albanian of any religion over to any foreigner. When word got out into Europe, unfortunately not much word did, but some did. When word got out as to what the Albanians were doing, Jews from as far away as Vienna, it's a long way, made it down to Albania and were embraced by the Albanian people. Let's put it on the table. They were almost all Muslims, but not like the jihadists of today.
Exactly.
Rescued by the Islamists. They were taught how to pray in an Islamic fashion. They gave them all Islamic names. Not one single Jew was turned over, and many who weren't even Albanians got into Albania and were rescued. So I'm glad you gave me a chance to say that.
And you see, we never hear that. You know, I mean, I wish this kind of stories came out more, not to think that every country just so hated the Jews that they got rid of them, you know?
Well, you're giving me what they call the koyach to get the stories out.
Right. I pray that you have that koach for a long, long, long time, and that means the strength. You know, one of the stories that I just loved was about the Vilna story, you know, the Israelis, why refuel at Vilna. Do you remember that story?
Oh, wow. Don't tell me you have time for that one.
Yes, I've read all your book.
I've got time, and that's not exactly the shortest one, but I'll try to... to put it on a bumper sticker, okay?
Okay.
I was at the Moscow Synagogue in 1956.
Yeah.
And I was about 26, and when I walked in, I think I lowered the average age to 99, and very old Jews sitting around.
Really?
And they didn't know who I was, but they could tell from my clothing I was from out of town.
Yeah.
And they came and they sat me on the bima. Now, in Orthodox Jewish services, you know, any American Baptist or Episcopalian or Catholic would go into cardiac arrest at a real Eastern European Orthodox service. It's perfectly all right to talk to each other. You know what I mean? You can carry on conversations with anybody else there while everybody else is davening.
You're kidding.
And so they just whisked me right up on the bima, on the platform. And all of a sudden, the back door opened, and in walked 26 blonde, crew-cut desert dragons. That was the Israeli football team.
Wow.
And, of course, they all spoke English. They were in Moscow to play the first of a scheduled three games.
Wow.
And I got, after the service, of course, I bonded with them. I wanted to know more about, you know, why I didn't know Israel was playing football. Russia didn't like Israel. Soviet Union
hated
Israel.
It's the soccer, right? When you say football,
how in
the world
could that be? Well, they explained this.
Yes.
The Soviets were disgusted with the Egyptians and the other Arabs as allies.
Yes.
They thought Nasser was a loose cannon And they thought Israel represented solidity. This was 1956. Israel was born in 1948.
Yes. Well, I was there. I was there.
You've heard
Harper.
Of ping-pong diplomacy with China.
Yes.
The Soviets suggested football diplomacy. They call it football. It's really soccer.
Soccer,
and,
right.
Israel said, okay. So Moscow said, all right, we'll play the first game in Moscow. Israel said, okay. They said, we'll send an Aeroflot plane, Soviet plane, to Israel to pick you up. And the Israelis said, we'd rather fly an El Al plane. And the Soviets said, sorry, foreign planes don't fly over Soviet airspace. The Israelis said, well, why don't you call us back when foreign planes do begin to fly over Soviet airspace? So the Soviets hung up, and they sort of stubborn Israelis. And then they wanted it badly. So they said, okay, we're going to send a Soviet navigator, and he's going to direct you from Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, Israel, right up to Moscow. And the Israelis said, no, we want to land in Vilna to refuel. And the Soviets went berserk, and they said, look at a map. There's no reason for a plane flying from Tel Aviv to Moscow to go to Vilna to refuel.
How far was Vilna from...
Israelis said, there's a lot more reason, comrade, for an Israeli plane to go to Vilna to refuel than there is for Israeli boys to go to Moscow to play football. You see, you don't understand who we want to refuel. Hitler didn't get us all. There were thousands of Jews still living in that Western Russian, Eastern Polish area.
Wow.
So the Soviets said, now we get it. They think they're going to inspire the Jews of Eastern Europe, Western Russia. They think they're going to rally and be inspired by the Star of David. Oh, we get it. Stupid Israelis don't realize we're not a democracy. They're going to land, they're going to refuel, they're going to take off 45 minutes later. Nobody's going to know a thing about it. Okay, here we go. Okay, they said, the plane can refuel at Vilna. Well, it was before Twitter and patter and clatter and
Facebook
and texting. But there were 65,000 Jews at the airport in Vilna to watch the plane with the Star of David on it land.
Are you kidding?
I heard the story in 1956. I can hardly tell it with a straight face today.
I know. It makes me cry because people don't realize what really the Jews have gone through and the determination of the Israelis to make sure there's a safe place for them always, you know?
Well,
how far was Vilna from Moscow? Do you know, miles away?
No, but it's I remember it. I remember looking at it at a map. It's quite a triangle. My boss, Tex McCrary, used to say the shortest distance between two points is an angle. Well, the Israelis proved it. There's no reason to go to Vilna to refuel if you're going from Tel Aviv to Moscow. But they did. They pulled it off.
You know, another thing I was going to comment, you know, I was trying to, because I've read your whole book, like I say, every page is folded over. That's why I don't know which story is more important than another. But you, why did you choose the order of the stories in which they're placed in the book? Was there any reason for that?
No, the only thing I asked was that the story of Sarah be last.
It is, and it is.
Outside of that, I figured as long as the stories are completely true and to some extent unbelievable, I don't care where they place them.
You know what I'd love for you to talk about is what you did during the Second World War as a young boy when you heard the overseas radio.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, that story lives in my heart today. For a completely different reason. We're talking about government, not necessarily the Obama government, but if the shoe fits, wear it. I'm talking about government. I lived in Greensboro, North Carolina, and we did not fear involvement in World War II physically.
Right.
Our men were drafted, but that was it.
Right.
And they brought the new radio in 1943.
Uh-huh.
And that new radio, oh, man, it dominated the living room like Fort Ticonderoga. And they had bands we'd never heard of. We had police bands. And we had short wave bands. I could get Can you imagine sitting in Greensboro, North Carolina, and hearing foreign languages that nobody could identify them? But it was shortwave.
Wow.
Oh,
wow.
Did I have fun with that radio. Well, all of a sudden, one day I was listening, and I heard a man, and it was I felt kind of strange. Now, I was just 13, but I felt kind of strange because the man was saying negative things about Winston Churchill.
Wow.
I'd never heard that before.
Yeah.
Then a woman came on and said even more negative things about American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, wait a minute. What is this? Well, then they gave station identification.
Yeah.
This was the overseas voice of the DNB, the Hitler Nazi DNB, Adolf Hitler's foreign broadcasting service.
Wow.
And I, oh, my God. So I just shoved my ear into the speaker and listened and listened and listened. And then this woman with a totally American accent and a very nice voice said, we're now going to give the names and addresses of American flyers who've been captured in recent days over Europe.
Yeah.
And listen to the way a 13-year-old thought. My first thought was, wow. I'd better get a pencil and a yellow pad and write these names down. Let Washington know.
Wow.
And my second thought was, oh, you stupid teenager. They got people up in Washington with earphones on whose job it is to listen to this. They're getting it. But then my third thought was the winner. My third thought was, how do we know these people with the earphones on in Washington are doing their job all that well?
Yes.
So at that point, I scrambled for a pencil and piece of paper, and all I got was one name and address, and then that was it. They didn't give any more. Well, I wrote a letter to the parents of that flyer, and the letter I got back, you know, I can't put it in monetary terms, but what I would give to have that letter again, my letter from Greensboro, North Carolina, a 13-year-old boy, was the first they'd ever heard that their son was alive. They had just been told by the War Department that their son was missing in action after a bombing raid.
Wow.
And they
you
said,
did a
my
you know
dear
what a
boy, and so on and so on and so on.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm glad you picked that.
Oh,
glad
God,
you picked
I told
that.
You.
I've never heard of Waco, Texas before, but I've never forgotten it since.
And see what happened with it later, right? You know, the other way. You know, I was going to say, I have to take a little short break, but what I'd love for you to talk to us about, too, is how you speak 26 languages and how we can learn to do... Okay?
We'll
be on a break. I hope we can talk while the break is on for about a minute.
Hello, this is Judge Eve Ellingwood, also known as Cohen and Sternlight. I'm a retired judge. I'm so happy to have the show on bbsradio.com, Station 1, on alternate Saturdays. My website is www.90210holocaust.com. That's HOLOCAUST.com. The story of my parents' murders in Beverly Hills by my brother and sister, and the theft of their millions, but with the help of corrupt doctors, lawyers, and judges, and taking place on a huge scale in our country. Also, I am a prophet, a seer, a healer, a seeing to the body, the past, the future, and would be able to help with counseling. To contact me for that would be at my email, eejudgeeve79@gmail.com. That's E like elephant, E like elephant, J-U, D like David, G for George, E for elephant, V for victory, E for elephant, 79@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Hello, we're back on the air. I am so honored and so touched to have Mr. Barry Farber on with his book, Cocktails with Molotov, which actually just came out June 5th. It's available at Amazon, other bookstores, and also at WND.com. He's the pioneer of conservative talk show. And I was going to ask him about the 26 languages that he speaks and how we can do the same. To me, that's absolutely amazing. Mr. Farber?
We have a language club in New York that we started in the 1980s.
Yes.
And we advise everybody who comes that it's dangerous to answer that question, how many languages do you speak? It's dangerous to answer that with a digit higher than one. The safest answer is I speak one language, my own English. Then you pause, and then you may say, however, I am a student of, and you may then add as many languages as you are a student of. I am a student of about 26. Now, the way it started is I loved the idea of foreign languages. But in North Carolina, the only one we could get in the first year of high school was Latin. And
that didn't
thrill me that much because there was no country where they spoke Latin, but at least it was a foreign language, and I was very excited. Now, I'm sure you can follow this with your knowledge of a highly inflected language like Hebrew. On the first day, there was nothing but vocabulary. They threw words at us, and we threw them back, and I was the whiz. Second day, same thing. Third day, same thing. The fourth day, I was absent. I had asthma. On the fifth day, there were no more words. It was like the whole course had changed into something else. It wasn't like a language anymore. It was more like trigonometry. I mean, there were words like nominative and genitive and ablative and dative or grammar. And I remember thinking, whatever this is, it's something that was grafted in by the school board, and it's going to go away soon, and we're going to get back to learning Latin, by which I meant words. We never got back. I sank like a rock. Now, I made what they call a D. Now, the principal called me in. I was the poorest one in the class, and the most highly motivated and the worst. And the principal said, Barry, you know, you've got to do well in Latin to be able to take Spanish and French later on, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade. But your grades in Latin are too poor for you to be allowed to take Spanish or French, so you're just going to have to take elective credit on this Latin and figure out what to do later. I hope your graduation is not delayed by your poor performance in Latin. Well, I couldn't let it go at that. I found a book. In Greensboro Bookstore, Will's Bookstore in Greensboro, Hugo's Italian Simplified. And I bought it, and to my delight and amazement, Italian was nothing but Latin with the difficulty removed. Like you fillet the bone out of a fish, it's like they filleted all the grammar, all the tough stuff out of Latin. The nouns did not change. They did not decline. Verbs changed, but not as wildly as they did in Latin. And I went through that book like a hot knife through butter. That same summer, I did the same thing with Spanish and French. And then
I went
to the high school physically, and I went to the one teacher in charge of all foreign language. There was only one. And I told her my story of doing poorly in Latin but loving languages. I said, will you give me a test right now? And see, if I do well, will you ask the principal if he'll waive that requirement and let me take Spanish or French right now? Well, I passed both tests, Spanish and French, right there in her room. She had never had a request like that before. She said,
how old were you?
Amazing.
Were you what? Were you 10th grader?
I'll do it. Now, which do you want to take, Spanish or French? I said, Miss Mitchell, may I take them both? So that was that, and I guess the honest answer is I started studying languages when I was 14, and I was too lazy to quit.
But what did you learn after that? Did you go with the other Romance languages?
No. After that, it was Chinese Mandarin.
I learned Chinese Mandarin enough
to be the mascot of a branch of the Chinese Nationalist Navy that was stationed in Miami, Florida. In the Hotel Alcazar, they had 500 Chinese sailors training there to take American destroyers back to fight the Japanese in the Far East. And after that, Norwegian, and that led to Danish and Swedish, and then that trip I told you about to Yugoslavia.
Yes.
I'd already studied Russian in college, but in Yugoslavia they speak Serbo-Croatian. It's a language similar to Russian, but far from identical. And, you know, one leads to another. When I got to New York, other waves of immigrants began to come to town. We have people from West Africa who speak Wolof, and we have Albanians.
That?
We have Armenians, we have Turks, Arabs from every imaginable Arab country.
Yes.
It's a great time. If everybody knew how easy it is to learn a foreign language today, it'd be a lot more popular, Robbie.
Well, you have a book, right? Is it still available, How to Learn Any Language?
Yeah, How to Learn Any Language.
Yeah, and where can we get that? Just go on Google or...
I guess you can. How to Learn Any Language. My name again is Barry Farber, B-A-R-R-Y-F-A-R-B-E-R. The owner of that book, the publisher, is Kensington.
Okay.
Kensington Press.
Yeah, because, see, to me, if we understand people's languages, then we understand them.
I'm sure you can get that on Amazon, too.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, thank you, thank you. You know, what I'd like to do is call attention to some more of your stories, like your story with Alfred Hitchcock, which I thought was so funny.
I was lucky.
Is that
to survive
okay?
It was my first month in broadcasting.
Yes.
You may say, why would Alfred Hitchcock give an interview to a kid who was just 1 month in the business? Well, he had to put out a movie, The Birds, starring Tippi Hedren. And he wasn't about to come to where we broadcast, but he was very happy to have us come to his hotel room. He thought it would be a normal one-hour interview.
Yes.
Oh, brother, was he mistaken. I walked into his hotel suite, stuck out my hand to shake his hand, tripped over the rug, fell flat on my face, knocked over a table on my way to the floor, a vase full of flowers, water shot like a long aerial torpedo across the room, scattering water and flowers everywhere, and there I was lying face down with a completely devastated Alfred Hitchcock standing over me with his hands on his hips. And that was not the worst of it. The hotel he was staying at, St. Regis, was the only hotel left in New York that still had direct current. Does that tell you how long I've been doing this? So he was fit to explode. But we got a hold of a house engineer and my engineer, and he patched it up. Finally, we were ready to go, and I said, I've got to come up with an opening question so good that Hitchcock is going to forgive and forget. And then I got it. I got an idea, and I said, oh, this is so good. He's going to walk me out of this suite with his arm around my neck and thank me for a great morning. So when the finger came to me and ready to go, I said, Alfred Hitchcock, I'm going to throw you a scenario and let you direct it for me. The scene is a local radio talk show. The host is a famous motion picture producer, and he's going to be murdered. How would you stage it? Without a moment's hesitation, that rich, lugubrious British accent, when I asked, the director's going to be murdered, how would you stage it? He said, well, given the proper interviewer, he could be bored to death. Well, a good time was had by all at my expense, but I got to tell you something, Your Honor. I'm proud that I left that in the tape. I could have cut it out. I left it in the tape.
I think that's wonderful. Your stories, as you make me laugh as you're telling them, this is how I've been laughing when I read your book, and that's why I want everybody to know about Cocktails with Molotov. Let me tell you another thing. You know, having been in Israel, well, Palestine at the time, and during the War for Independence, to me, Molotov cocktails meant these man-made, alcohol-infused bottles of things.
Absolutely.
So you want to tell your story of Molotov?
That's the title story. Why not?
Yes.
Now, these stories are a little bit like magic tricks. When I tell you one line beyond the shocker, I had cocktails with Molotov. Beginning with the next line, I'm like a magician who shows you how the trick works. It loses a lot of its mystique. But anyhow, in 1956,
Yes.
There were so few of us Americans in Moscow on July the 4th that the American embassy invited all of us to the residence ambassador, the ambassador's residence, rather, to his outdoor garden party.
Oh.
And we went, I and my North Carolina buddy, brother journalist, Chuck Hauser, and we went, and at a certain moment, the band struck up, and in walked the Soviet Big Five, Khrushchev, Malyankov, Kaganovich, Pilov, and Molotov. I felt like I was looking up at a communist Mount Rushmore, and I looked at that unmistakable face, Molotov. I said, "You're Molotov." He said, "Yes." I said, "I'm Barry Farber. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina, in America." He said, "How long have you been in the Soviet Union?" I said, "2 days." He said, "How long do you plan to stay?" I said, "Well, we hope to stay 17 days. At that moment, one of his aides came and took him by the elbow over to the American ambassador, Chip Bowler, across the garden.
Yes.
And 35 years later, I was on the air. And
yes.
a revisionist historian, that's a polite way to call somebody who says President Truman was the warmonger and the bad guy, and all Joseph Stalin wanted to do was preserve the gains of the working class.
For heaven's sakes.
I was talking about Yugoslavia being considered like Israel all over the world because they feared a Soviet invasion every night.
Wow.
And this annoyed the professor, and he said, "Mr. Farber, in his 1955 memoirs, Vyacheslav Molotov clearly emphasized that Joseph Stalin never had any intention of invading Yugoslavia militarily." And I frowned and I said, "Well, that is funny, because in my 1956 conference with Molotov, he didn't say a word about it." So it paid off for me. Cocktail with Molotov paid off.
You know, Mr. Farber, it's like you've been part of history of the world. It's really what your life has been like. Do you ever feel that? Do you think that's the case?
You know, I was just talking night before last to a great Cuban freedom writer, Humberto Fontova. And, you know, you're absolutely right there. Woody Allen made a movie called Zelig. And he was just a plain old guy, a schlep, a schlub, a nothing, a schmendrick. But he wound up in the middle of every kind of history. Do you remember? There was an American. In the early days, there were no Soviets around Fidel Castro. They stayed hidden. They knew what was good for them. That alliance stayed very secret. And there was an American businessman in Havana. Organized other American businessmen to boost Fidel Castro, help kick out the dictator Batista, who compared to Castro was not much of a dictator. He organized, he was the interpreter at Castro's press conferences. And I remember he left his own home and checked into a hotel because the revolution needed him. He was the only one that Castro trusted who could speak fluent Spanish and English. And he was the interpreter and the go-to guy if you wanted to talk to Castro or Raul. Well, I remember of course, they dumped him, that they got rid of him so the Soviets could surface. They couldn't let an American see what was going on. I walked into, his name was Ira Wolpert, W-O-L-P-E-R-T. I walked into his hotel room in Havana one night in January 1959, and he was on the phone with Carlos Franchi, Castro's editor of the pro-communist newspaper. And he was saying, "Okay, Franchi, no, I'm not hurt. I'm not hurt at all. No, I understand. I don't want to intrude. No, this is all yours. This is your revolution. I just wanted to help. I'll help as long as I can. I understand. I'm not hurt. I walked in at the moment when the mask came off and the Soviets took the place of those
You had also another story about this Jewish rabbi who went to visit his brother in Havana.
A story that good has to be true.
It was wonderful. Do you want to, because we only have a few minutes left.
That's an easy one. There was a completely apolitical Orthodox rabbi in Brooklyn who had a brother in Havana.
Yes.
And he went down there after Hanukkah one year. And on New Year's Day, he got up to take a little walk with his beard and everything. You know, the beard was Castro's badge. What a badge. You couldn't wear it one day and not wear it the next day. And a group of Castro's supporters saw this rabbi with his cane and his beard, and they thought he was the advanced Castro man in the Vedado section. Well, he didn't know any Spanish. They hoisted him on their shoulders, and he was swatting him with his cane, yelling, "Put me down, put me down." And it, the whole thing was finally settled. It was finally settled. But then the bookend of the story is a member of Castro's initial cabinet, Raul Chibas, went to Colombia, spoke fluent English, and 18 months after Castro took over, he'd had enough. He and his wife had fled, and he was hiding out in the Miami area. Well, I got a hold of a journalist at the Miami Herald, and I managed to win his trust over the phone. I don't think this can be done by phone today. I think you would need a lot more confidence building. But I convinced him I was real over the phone, and would he please, does he know where Raul Chibas is hiding? And he gave me the hotel on the corner of Ocean Drive and 8th Street in Miami Beach. And guess what? Here was, we got the bearded rabbi from Brooklyn who was mistaken as a Castro advance trooper.
Yes.
And now we've got, 18 months later, Raul Chibas with his Castro beard hiding out in a hotel on the corner of Ocean Drive and 8th Street in Miami Beach, posing as an Orthodox Jew. I mean, does it turn around or does it not turn around?
Oh, God bless you, Mr. Farber. I've enjoyed so much having you on. I cannot recommend your book highly enough. If people want to have a glimpse of history done with humor and from a point of view of an honorable Southern gentleman who is Jewish. And you know what? Well, you only have a Southern accent when you say South Carolina.
No, North Carolina, you know.
Sorry.
My cousin Gurney says a Southern accent is the world's best substitute for having something to say. I certainly enjoyed the hour, Your Honor, and I feel vindicated before your bench.
Oh, you betcha. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful rest of the day, and shalom to you.
You've given us a wonderful kickoff into Father's Day, and I thank you for it. I wish you a great weekend.
Thank you. Happy Father's Day to you, too. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful
weekend. Take care, and best to Doug.
Pardon me? The what?
I said best to Doug.
Oh, thank you. Yes,
the man whose wizardry is keeping us on the air together.
Exactly. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. And you've got to get Mr. Farber's book, Cocktails with Molotov, and also How You Can Speak Any Language, which we all need to do. Thank you so much, all of you. We'll see you in 2 weeks. My guest will be Christine McGuire, who will talk about how she went into witchcraft and came back to knowing God in her life. All of you have a wonderful weekend. Happy Father's Day. And thank you, Mr. Farber. Tadaba.